Space isn't always so empty, and vacuum isn't always the threat. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. There were serious debates in the lunar science community about what the surface of the moon would be like in advance of the first surface missions. Surely it was made of rock, but of what chemistry? And what had billions of years of exposure to solar radiation, vacuum, and meteorite impacts done to the upper layers of the crust? What would the regolith, the lunar equivalent of topsoil, be like? And would it pose a problem for landers and surface operations? Apollo and other early lander and rover missions gave a great deal of insight and some surprises. While it was safe to land, the spacecraft didn't sink into the regolith. The dust turned out to have some surprising and inconvenient properties that made it a potential challenge to long-term work on the lunar surface. The lessons learned there, and on later missions in low Earth orbit, have taught us a great deal about how to design spacesuits to protect astronauts during work in orbit and on planetary surfaces. Dr. Ryan Kobrick has conducted research into the effects and properties of lunar dust, and in strategies for spacesuit design. He's now a project manager at Space Florida and executive director of Yuri's Night. I spoke with him about his work and about how even in space one must dress for the occasion. So good evening and welcome to the program. Dr. Kobrick.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, so welcome to Western Worlds.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's great to be here.
Great. And happy to talk to you. So I understand that on the Apollo missions, the astronauts found out that the lunar dust was a surprisingly big hassle. How did this manifest itself? How did we find out that this was a problem?
Well, just like any great exploration, there's so many variables leading up to any kind of mission or adventure that you're so busy worrying about the variables that you know about, and you're not thinking about what are the things that might occur along the way. And dust was one of those big ones that they really got into once they arrived. And so just so everyone knows, on the moon there isn't an atmosphere. Obviously, it's a near vacuum environment. And because of that, it's got constant micrometeorite bombardment. And that those micrometeorites are just bursting apart everything on the surface. It's breaking it down, and you're getting glass-like shards everywhere. And because there's no weathering, in the terms that we know about it, where there's, you know, lots of fluid motion, the particles aren't rolling on the ground or anything like that, so they stay sharp. So that kind of led to all the different issues that the astronauts during the Apollo missions had, and also a lot of the surface robotics are, you know, have experienced those issues in the past, and I'm sure future missions are going to have similar problems.
So what kind of issues are there, for example? What problems are there for machinery to start?
Sure. Well, the main area that I looked at for my PhD research was actually abrasion. And so abrasion is when you take particles or a single particle, rub or slide across the surface, and it cuts into it. That specific problem is what I was looking at, and we'll get into that a little bit further. But there's different electrostatic charging that occurs because of the environment. That causes particles to cling to things. If you imagine your visor getting a layer of dust across it because all the particles are so small that they're just adhering to everything. There's many other areas that tons of different researchers have kind of covered. But in terms of mechanical, if you think also of playing in the sandbox and getting sand into everything, and just imagine those grains of sand being so small that they're getting into within gears that are within gears. Some of the particles were found to actually make their way through the different layers of the spacesuit. And so just having all those issues just kind of compounded on top of each other, and with the short duration of missions that the Apollo missions went through, it didn't build up to enough to a point where it actually slowed down their operations. But if they're in the field for another 2 or 3 days, or, you know, 2 or 3 more EVAs where they're out on the surface doing moonwalks, then their suits might have had major problems that would have stopped them from doing any more exploration.
Okay, so I guess do we really understand the long-term effects of this, or is it just still hints of it from that limited Apollo experience?
It's limited. Not only is it limited in number of missions that we've had in our kind of historic database, but it's limited on the locations that we've gone exploring. Just like here on Earth, every single spot that you go to is going to have a completely different makeup, mineralogy, and everything else. And so even though we have a pretty good idea of what the bulk material is across the moon, and there's two major regions, there's the highlands, and then there's the kind of the mare, which are the more of the lava flows. Between the two, it's still not very... We don't have the kind of the fine details of all the areas that make up those two major areas. So in one location, the mineralogy could be such that if you look at some of the hardest minerals on the moon, like the spinels, and you find a high concentration area of spinels on the moon, that might indicate that this could be an area that really rips apart spacesuits and equipment, because of the high hardness factor. It means it's going to dig into most materials as they rub together. So there's a lot of interesting areas that we still need to explore, and the more and more missions that we send to the moon, the more we map the moon and learn about its composition, the better we can understand what might be an ideal landing site.
Okay.
For future missions.
So still some unknowns.
More than a few.
Right. So any thoughts then on how we can adapt to this? Are we starting to figure this out?
Well, the data that we did collect was getting us on the right track. We went from knowing how to do the very basics of just brushing away dust to using wet wipes and, you know, very simple equipment just to kind of mitigate the short-term effects. But what it led into is a lot of new architectures. You'll see airlocks that are involved, dust cleaning strategies. There's research groups that are looking at electrostatic shielding, where you would put electrostatics within, just say, a visor or dial and activate it, and it would help push the dust away through a charge. Because the particles are in a vacuum and they're small, they're easily susceptible to being charged. So all those factors are definitely, you know, those are all the things that we know from the history of all of this. And now hopefully when we return, we'll be able to leverage that and be a lot more prepared for safer operations and longer duration operations.
And so is this a problem just for operations on the moon, or is it going to be other targets, other planetary bodies where we're still going to have to deal with this?
It's going to be a similar issue into a lot of low-gravity environments. If you just picture any kind of object floating in space that's being hit nonstop by micrometeorites just from across the universe, those bodies, you can kind of relate to being similar to the moon. The moon obviously has the advantage of being shielded by Earth, and vice versa, the moon shields us as well. But other objects are impacted at a higher rate because of they don't have as much proximity, so asteroids are going to be dusty bodies. And also has to do with like how large the body is and the gravitational forces holding it together. But we can expect a lot of near vacuum environments to definitely have dusty effects that we're going to have to watch out for.
Well, it sounds like something that we really need to sort out then. Are there other environmental problems similar to this that we might not expect in these kind of environments that we're learning we have to deal with?
Well, we definitely have highlighted the major, not showstoppers, but things that we need to address for any kind of mission, especially going past the moon towards Mars, of course, is radiation protection. We have to identify several other factors that are going to kind of slow us down in terms of propulsion. Like, can we reduce the amount of time that we're spending in zero G so the body's not deconditioning? So those two are kind of number one and two up there. And the surface effects are really going to depend on a lot of things. How much mass can we launch? If we can launch a ton of mass, that means we can have, just say, a ton of spacesuits in our wardrobe and be able to wear something like dust coveralls and just throw them out and go over to the next pair over the suit. And, you know, simple solutions like that might be the easiest, but it all has to do with the kind of mass game when it comes to launching.
Okay. Now, speaking of those spacesuits, how difficult is it to design suits that can handle all of these things at once?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things that looked at the University of Colorado is, if you were doing an architecture towards the moon or Mars, how many suits would you need? Can you combine suits? Because if you think about it, there's actually three or four different types of spacesuits, and the goal would be to have interchangeable parts that are reconfigurable and that you can kind of use for different elements of the mission. So just kind of, if you walk yourself through a mission, the first thing, of course, is launch. So you need a launch safety suit that can deal with depressurization, potential cabin fires, and definitely you would need mobility within your arms to be able to get to controls. You would need dexterity in your hands to be able to either hold things, push buttons, controls, anything along those lines. And so those are really important issues for a suit like that. And then you need to consider the zero gravity kind of environment. Once you're free of the bonds of Earth and you're floating around, you need a suit that you're able to do more in terms of, again, going towards mobility and everything else. But you're also now in a very harsh environment with temperatures fluctuating from extremely cold to extremely hot. So that all goes into the suit architecture itself. And then, of course, for surface activities, you need to have something that you're, just say in case of the moon, lop instead of walk, since you don't really need to walk. But when it gets to Mars with the gravity levels a little bit higher, you are going to need to be able to walk. So having the ability to have a suit that you're not spending all your energy fighting against to move. And what I mean by that is, if you pressurize a suit in order to, you know, keep the pressure against the body, then you're basically fighting the suit to bend it. And there's a lot of mechanical tricks that you can use in terms of the elbow joints and rotating bearings and everything like that. But if you take a balloon and you imagine trying to bend it and that your arm's inside of that, you're kind of fighting against being inside a giant balloon. So the more we can get a suit to fit better and address these kind of concerns, the more energy can go into actually doing field work instead of just fighting to keep moving.
Yeah, and I gather that gloves in particular are a real challenge for this.
Yeah, NASA has a Centennial Challenge to help address the issue of astronaut gloves, and there's a lot of cool innovations that came out of there. What if we consider even going further? What if we put a current through a glove and we use power to help actuate fingers and different joints that help us with grip strength and everything else? And everyone who's seen Gravity so far knows how important grip strength is. I think that was abundantly clear from most of the scenes without giving away any spoilers. But it's just, suits are, have a, there's not a lot going on that can be go on right now just because of where we're at in the program. So as things progress, then more and more of these ideas can become reality.
And speaking of progress, have we managed to improve at least the suits of today since the Apollo days?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at today's EMU, which is the U.S. version of the spacesuit, extravehicular mobility unit. That's what you see, that the white puffy suit that astronauts use on spacewalks when they're fixing up the International Space Station. The suit's heritage comes from the Apollo suit. The big difference is, because you don't have to walk in zero G while working on the station, there wasn't really a lot of advancement that needed to be done for the legs. But if we had maintained going to the moon, that would have changed for sure, because they didn't have a lot of movement within the legs. They were kind of like the Michelin man or the Stay Puft Marshmallow man or whatever reference you want to use for big puffy person. But they definitely made improvements in the gloves. There's a lot of shoulder injuries that they experienced while training in the neutral buoyancy lab, and they kind of tried to adapt that so that they would increase mobility within the kind of hard upper torso. All the gadgets and tools, if you think about some of the major things we've learned about the space station, is how to construct stations and somewhat your infrastructure in space. So all the tools that are involved, they're all custom made and pretty cool stuff when you think about it. When you don't really think about it on Earth where you're using a hand drill or something and it's rotating. But in space, if you were to use that, you would start rotating around it without having a torque going the other way. Or that would increase your internal momentum or inertia, and that would have to be spun off in another way. So there's just the amount of work that goes into all that is unbelievable.
Right. So given that we aren't actually working on the surface of the moon or Mars right now with astronauts, what's our best bet for testing these new suit designs and technologies to make them ready for those days when we are?
So to test suits or any technology, the best bang for your buck is analog research. Analog research essentially means doing work in an environment that's analogous to what you want to be doing your final mission in. So for spaceflight, there's a lot of different ones. I've been involved with a lot of Mars simulations at the Mars Desert Research Station, and I did a 100-day mission up at the Flashline Mars Arctic Research Station in Nunavut on Devon Island. And from those, you're really simulating what it's like to be isolated, living inside of a small capsule with a crew. There's a lot of human factors in that kind of simulation. With that, you can be testing suits as well. You can be testing, even though you're in 1G on Earth compared to like a third on Mars, a third of a G, you're still able to get an idea of how the mobility would work, how would the dexterity of gloves work when you're trying to drill to get a sample. There's a lot of overlap that can be done there. And so the astronauts train in the Nutrabuoyancy Lab in Johnson in Houston. And what that simulates is sort of the zero gravity environment. So scuba diving is one of the closest things you can get to being in space. And those kind of similarities, the more variables that you can simulate from the environment, the better the analog. So there's a dozens of different things, even something as simple as a small chamber where you pump it down to a near vacuum to try to, you know, operate different equipment to see how it'll react to having no pressure on it. And it has to maintain its own pressure so it doesn't, just say like a glove, for instance, doesn't rip open or anything along those lines. There's tons of little things that can be done for that kind of research for pretty cheap.
Okay. And maybe just staying on Earth to wrap up, one of your current projects, you're involved with the Yuri's Night event. And what's your role there?
So for Yuri's Night, I'm the executive director. And what that essentially means is that I help all volunteer teams stay on track to prepare us for April 12th every year. And so Yuri's Night is the World Space Party. And so every April 12th around the world, events celebrate human space flight from our first human in space, Yuri Gagarin, which was April 12th, 1961. But then 20 years later, it was the first space shuttle flight, 1981. And so when Yuri's Night was formed in 2001, another 20 years later, the idea was to bring people together on this kind of cosmic date and get everyone to celebrate. So as executive director, I work with we have about 30 people that are volunteering on the global executive team. And our main role is to help get the word out about Yuri's Night, but also to help facilitate the interactions across the world. So we have on our website, which is just yurisnight.net, people from around the world will register their events. And by registering, people can also find out, oh, where can I go attend one of these events and learn a little bit more about space. And we provide contests. We try to get cool videos. Astronaut Chris Hadfield, as commander of the International Space Station, was able to send us a Yuri's Night greeting for 2013, which is just spectacular because it's very difficult to get any kind of recording from the space station. They're very busy up there. And Chris was fantastic with working with our team to get that down to us. And CSA, the Canadian Space Agency, also did a tweet up in Edmonton, which was one of the first ones out on the west side of Canada, and which was really cool because they had Chris talking to a group of school children from across that area. And they also invited people to come to do a tweet up. So they would message everyone across the world on Twitter what was going on and what was being said. And so that in itself is a great example of how we're kind of breaking down boundaries and cultures and connecting people around the world and off the world to celebrate space. And just to kind of give people an idea of how Yuri's Night is celebrated, it's celebrated from anything from a couple people getting together for dinner or barbecue, all the way up to tens of thousands of people celebrating with DJs. And so we've had schools get involved with space days. We've had planetariums, museums. Some of the well-known events in the U.S. include a couple at NASA Ames out on the West Coast in California, where they had over 6,000 people and a DJ in one of the hangars, and they had all these cool exhibits out of people showing off their hardware. And so it's very inclusive. It's kind of all ages, all cultural, all humans, anywhere around can be part of Yuri's Night. So last year, I think we had about 360 events in over 50 countries, and it just continues to grow year after year. This was our 11th year this past year.
Cool. Well, it sounds like a fun and diverse event, and I guess people have lots of time before the next April to prepare and
Absolutely.
Register their events.
I expect at least 5 events at Western this year.
Well, we'll do our best.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks for talking to us tonight, and I hope we hear more about Yuri's Night and about efforts to work with astronauts on other planets.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So you look at pictures from the Apollo missions to the surface of the moon, and it just looks like this cold, empty, benign, harmless, if rigid place. But boy, that dust starts to sound like it's a real hassle.
Mm-hmm. I did not know, like, until, you know, reading a lot about it, that the dust on moon is way more harmful than you would think about, you know, dust here on Earth. I mean, obviously, you don't like to be in a dust storm here either. Mm-hmm. But over there, like, getting into the spacesuit layers, like, imagine trying to design a spacesuit for, you know, Mars, and you don't even know if that's going to get into your spacesuit when you get there.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, the idea that it even is penetrating some of the outer layers, that's scary stuff.
Yeah.
And so, getting into all the seals and the doors and tracking, that's... and apparently it's not the chemistry so much as the mechanics of it. It's sharp and it's jagged and it's messy.
Yeah, it's that whole lack of water and wind erosion on the surface of the moon. I studied lunar dust a little bit myself during my master's, and I was also really surprised to learn exactly how nasty it is. But that's just what I was looking at, was the physical properties and just how angular and jagged those particles are. And I was lucky enough to look at a sample, one of the Apollo samples, under a scanning electron microscope, and it's beautiful, but yeah, it's nasty stuff.
It's nasty stuff.
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, luckily, you mentioned Mars. Luckily, on Mars, there is an atmosphere. So planets where there are atmospheres, there is wind, at least, and sometimes water. So in the case of Mars, we see evidence that there was some water erosion going on. So hopefully the dust wouldn't be quite as nasty in that sense. There are other things that would make it very different than what we have here on the Earth. But but yeah, the moon is...
Yeah. It was unexpected, I think, right? When they
I think
got
so, yeah.
there.
I think they didn't know what to expect. Like, they kind of thought that the spacecraft were just going to settle into the dust and...
They didn't know, as it turns out. Yeah, I had a conversation with Jim Burke, who was one of the earliest planetary scientists working on the planetary science side of the Apollo program, and yeah, he confirmed that they weren't exactly sure. They were, you know, kind of confident that it would go this way, but based on what evidence, right? They just did not know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and that's, you know, strange new worlds, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's impressive that they made that work. I guess a lot of those Apollo suits were sort of hand-sewn, you know, best guess of what would be suitable for the surface of the moon. We got a little more information now, but...
We do. We have quite a bit more information now. There were a lot of samples returned from the Apollo missions, and some from some of the Russian missions as well returned. So we do have some dust samples here on the Earth and some rock samples to look at, but... And we have not been to the moon that many times, so we really don't know.
And I gather for people who are doing this kind of engineering... There aren't enough samples to go play in a sandbox of it.
That's right.
And so they have to go to a lot of effort to produce, like, lunar dust or regolith simulants to try and give them something to test with.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was involved with for my master's research as well, was developing this fake moon dirt. I was making a recipe for fake moon dirt. So
nice.
Creating a lunar regolith simulant, to put it in the proper terms. But
yeah,
it is quite a challenge. So we had to look at using different combinations of crushing machines to... crush the grains down to the right size and shape without accidentally rounding those edges, so they're still jagged like glass and whatever.
That's an interesting mechanical problem.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's, I mean, that's one side of it, like we've been talking about, but there is the chemical side as well, and if you're looking at it from a geological perspective, it's the chemistry of a rock that determines the way it's going to break, the way it's going to fracture, or if it's going to cleave along even planes or whatever. So yeah, it's an interesting geology problem. But now we do have tons and tons of fake moon dirt to play in.
Yeah.
Is it good enough? That's the real question. It depends on what you're trying to simulate. But but you're right, Raymond. We certainly do not have enough samples returned from the missions to be able to just go and play with that. So it's very limited, the studies that they've been able to do with the actual real lunar dust.
It's one of the things that impresses me about working in space stuff is the unusual and often very unexpected problems that you end up facing during your design process.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, dirt is not dirt. Dirt on the moon is quite different from dirt here. Yeah.
I really like when you pointed out that the suits used back then are completely different than what we are, somewhat different than what we use right now. So while designing new kinds of suits, we have to take into account where is this going and how is that going to affect what there is on that planet or celestial object. For example, if you're going to moon, now we would have to take into account all that research that's being done on, you know, the kinds of things it can do to the spacesuit.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important, like, even with other than geological perspective, it's very important, you know, if you're sending someone there, make sure they don't inhale that stuff.
Yeah, I found it hard enough to find a good pair of pants to go working in the Arctic. Never mind trying to design the right thing for field work on the moon.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he mentions during the interview how, you know, you might design something for a weightless EVA crawling around the outside of the spacecraft, but that might not at all be suited to working on the surface.
Yeah, you need very, very different spacesuits for any different object, like we were saying, because of the geology, because of the atmosphere or lack thereof.
Yeah.
The gravity, how much can the spacesuit weigh? How much are you going to be fighting against it or not?
So yeah.
Those spacesuits that they use when they go out of the space station, for example, they weigh quite a lot, like hundreds of kilograms, I believe.
Really? That's
I'm not
heavy.
Sure of the exact weight.
I don't but know they are heavy. Know,
but
that's
yeah.
what
they're very, very heavy. You can't walk around in them on the Earth. So when we go out and do our simulated planetary missions or simulated whatever missions, this is why they do this underwater for the space station, right? They have to wear the suits underwater to simulate that weightlessness.
Yeah,
yeah, and they don't put the suit on and, like, hop in the pool. They have to be, like, lifted with a crane.
With a crane.
Yeah.
You can't just... No, yeah, it's really complicated. And then, so when we're doing, like, Moon or Mars mission simulations, walking around on the surface of the Earth, pretending like we're on the surface of another planet, we don't use the real suits that they would use, obviously, just because the Moon with 1/6 gravity, the suit's going to be a lot heavier, or it can be a lot heavier, and therefore a lot more robust for the Moon than you'd want to be walking around in on the Earth. It would feel very different, so that's a whole nother complication, is how do you test these things and be able to walk around in them or move around in them.
Yeah, and you know, you'd imagine trying to design a mission to Mars, which has humans going along for the ride, and you know, you've got mass and energy and everything else are really, really tightly constrained, and mass is one of the big ones. And you've got all these different kinds of spacesuits that you need, and they take up different amounts of space, and they take up different amounts of mass, and you have to say, okay, what is the minimum number of spacesuits or combinations of spacesuit parts that we can get away with, to do all the jobs. And there's really like a complicated systems engineering problem there of optimizing that just for this one question of spacesuits.
Yeah, that's right. And also to date, the missions that have gone to the surface of another planetary body in our solar system have just been the Apollo mission. So just 6 visits to the moon. Each of those was very, very short in duration. Now we're talking about longer duration missions. The spacesuits are going to have to be a lot more robust and last a lot longer. So it's a completely different question than what we faced in the past. Those ones, even if they only lasted for a few days, that was enough.
That was it. That was the whole mission. And they could be worn out after 3 days.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah. And I mean, given that, and that was a long time ago, I would say comparatively, like all the research that has been done in last few decades has been way before that. So all that we have, you know, learned, tested stuff has not gone up there to make sure, you know, it works here on Earth. What about there? We haven't got time to test it. We have all the models. We have, you know, maybe we have a design, but this was done way back in, what, 60s and 70s. Do we have a new suit? Does that, you know, it works here on Earth? Did we try it on Moon? Would it work? We don't know, right? We need missions for that.
That's well, that's one thing. There, I mean, you can test different factors. So you can have like vacuum chambers, and you can you can test different aspects. But putting everything all together into that one package, that's the challenge that we face with analog mission simulation.
Full up overall test. That's hard.
Yeah, it's hard, and we can hit most of the variables in various combinations to the point where we're convinced, and that's that whole technology readiness level, the testing of the technologies. We can get to a point where we're reasonably comfortable, but you're right, there are always going to be, there's always the potential for unknowns until we get to that planetary body itself.
And hopefully that's the path forward, is to get to the planetary body and explore it in a progressive sort of stage-wise way. We'll do another three-day sortie, but then do a two-week, and then do a longer, longer thing, and hopefully that way we'll be able to use these terrestrial tests as a lead-in to finally figuring out how and whether these things work.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Melissa Battler, Parshati Patel, and Raymond Francis. Our editors were Anna Noon and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can once again make world enough in time to join us next week, right here on astronomy.fm. Thank you.